on the Mistral side, you know, I was actually kind of surprised, but I had mixed feelings about it's kind of a plain vanilla Transformer, right? Like, there's a few little tweaks in there, but there's no fancy attention mechanisms. There's no attempt at linear attention scaling. It's just a big old dense attention model, and it's really good.
All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a panel of the smartest minds in technology to distill down what's important in the latest news in artificial intelligence. Joining us today are three incredible panelists. We've got Aaron Bautman, IBM Fellow Master Inventor, Abraham Daniels, Senior Technical Product Manager for Granite, and Gabe Goodhart, Chief Architect, AI Open Innovation. Welcome back to the show, all three of you. Lots to talk about today. We've got a welter of new model releases. We'll talk a little bit about the future of the scaling laws and dust up that's happening between Amazon and ChatGPT. But first, we've got Eileen with the news.
Hey, everyone. I'm Eileen McConnon, a tech news writer for IBM Think. Here are this week's AI headlines. At Amazon's annual reInvent conference, the tech giant launched three new agents that can handle coding, security, and operations independently for hours or days at a time. IBM has shared early results that its AI coding assistant named Bob has helped IBM developers improve their productivity by 45%. The numbers are in. Globally, AI and agents influenced $14.2 billion in sales on Black Friday, according to software firm Salesforce. AI for dinner? Pasha is a new private robot chef that can prepare complex multi-step dishes. Hello, smart kitchen. For more, subscribe to the Think newsletter, linked in the show notes. And now back to the episode.
I was looking at the calendar, and there's really not a whole many few days before the end of the year. But basically, the AI news hits keep coming. And literally, in the last few weeks, we have had not one, not two, but three fairly major model launches by competing labs in the space. So Claude Opus 4.5 is out, Mistral 3 is out, and also DeepSeek 3.2 is out. And so, Gabe, I want to kick it over to you first. Obviously, with Mistral 3 and DeepSeek 3.2, open is a big theme of this round of launches. And so kind of want you to just talk a little bit about what you're seeing with Mistral 3 and DeepSeek 3.2, and I guess what listeners should take away from it.
Yeah, awesome. So as you said, it's the end of the year. Everyone's cramming to have that last bit of news for people to
crunch
go.
Mode.
I don't know about you guys, but I've always referred to it as Funcember here at IBM, because it's when things start to slow down and you actually get some time to play with stuff. It's actually a great time to launch an experimental new model for people to then play with over the holidays and a little bit of downtime. So I think it's you know, it's kind of fun and clever. People are going to have lots of new toys on their either laptops or servers, depending on which size of model you pick and choose. So, you know, when I was playing with these, I think in some ways, the fact that they're all hitting thick and fast right now speaks to the fact that we are really hitting this just wealth of riches in the model space. Like, they're all such great models. You know, same with the ones we talked about the last time we were on talking
it's always
about
good.
Gemini. Yeah, there are so many good models out there, which is awesome. And it makes it a little harder to have sort of a fine-tuned point on any of these. But what I definitely noticed that I thought was interesting here is that I think these respective labs, at least on the open side, are really leaning into their strengths. So I noticed that, you know, with the DeepSeek release, they have yet another novel attention mechanism that aims to further dig into and, you know, improve on, I've got a giant model, but I can still run it really efficiently, right? That was one of the major breakthroughs with, you know, R1 and the V3 series. And you're seeing them pushing yet another one here with their sparse attention mechanism here with 3.2. So really cool to see that they're continuing to iterate in that space. On the Mistral side, you know, I was actually kind of surprised, but I had mixed feelings about it's kind of a plain vanilla transformer, right? Like there's a few little tweaks in there, but there's no fancy attention mechanisms. There's no attempt at linear attention scaling. It's just a big old dense attention model. And it's really good. I think what their innovation was is that every one of their models up and down the line had vision capabilities, which is pretty cool to just see that not as like an extra, but just as bread and butter. These are multimodal models out of the box. They work great on text, and the vision is just more rather than a lot of times you think about, especially at the smaller end of the scale, you get models where you have to kind of make a trade-off between quality in multimodality and like pure quality in text. And it seems like they've figured out a pretty clever way to actually just boost it really well. So, you know, I did a little dabbling with all of these yesterday. I tried to experiment with a pretty hard coding problem I'm trying to tackle right now around metal kernel optimization for Llama CPP, which frankly, I don't know much about. And I threw it at—
That's very specific.
Yeah, it is very specific. I threw it on all three of the big size models. And, you know, each one of them gave me some really, you know, interesting tips on optimizations. So again, like I don't have any clear way of saying, oh, this one blew me away and this one, you know, really fell flat. They all did great. They're all great models at the top size. What I did think was really cool is that I was able to pull Minstrel 3B on my, you know, my dev box and just crank away on multimodality workflows through OpenWeb UI. And that was really fun too. So I love seeing both ends of the spectrum here, especially from the Mistral release. You know, I kind of wish I could get my hands more tightly around the DeepSeek release so I could play with it more. You know, I'm a love to tinker with it myself kind of person. And at the top end of the scale, they're still all delivering great quality. So
yeah, for sure. And Abraham, maybe I'll kick it over to you. I mean, I want to build on that comment that Gabe had, which is there's so many models. They're all great. And as a result, it's almost hard to make distinctions between them because it's all really good, basically. And there's a famous kind of memo from the early days of this competition. And by that, I mean, I don't know, a few years ago that leaked out of Google that said, look, at the end of the day, there is no moat to these models because everything's going to be commodified. Everything's kind of going to be great and all free and available in a certain sense. Do you have a sense of how open source projects, labs need to be able to stay differentiated in this market? Or is this just kind of inevitable that like everything will be great and then everybody will kind of be very similar in the models that they launch?
It's a good question. So I think open source labs differentiate from closed source by, you know, being open source, to be honest. I think that really is their moat there. In terms of like, you know, performance and capabilities, I think with the first DeepSeek R1, you really saw that you don't necessarily need to be one of these, you know, highly funded, you know, hundreds of thousands of GPUs trained, you know, organizations to be able to really release something that's state of the art. I think what you're starting to, what I saw with DeepSeek and with Claude is kind of leaning into what you do really well, kind of as Gabe mentioned, in terms of, you know, Claude Opus really doubling down on, you know, software engineering as their, you know, primary target and really ensuring that they maintain kind of like a chokehold on that particular use case or those particular capabilities. What I kind of thought was cool for DeepSeek was their kind of reasoning first for agents for tool calling. So really kind of, I think you're starting to see a lot of model releases really focus on being hyper performant when it comes to tool calling or any sort of agentic workflows as they start to see like that's the next frontier in terms of how LLMs are going to be used in place of standalone. I think what I really liked about this, like, you know, last number of model releases is Mistral's going back into open source and not with their, you know, bespoke research licenses, really going back to the Apache 2.0 roots of the early open model kind of efforts. But yeah, so in terms of differentiating between open source and closed source, I think, you know, right now they're kind of neck and neck in most cases. And I think that, you know, there's a comment about, you know, what is good enough in terms of what's out there. And I think you know, it really depends on, you know, what your business case is and what you're actually trying to solve.
And Abe, I think you put an interesting point on that one, actually, with the DeepSeek reasoning and tool calling is that I really think each lab is going to choose their specialty, right? Like DeepSeek is clearly trying to be the reasoning lab. So they're going to try and make their reasoning the best, no matter what else you're using it for. You know, Anthropic is clearly trying to be the best developer model shop. And they're really going to lean in heavily on that one. You know, so I think that is what you'll probably end up seeing is that individual labs, start to differentiate by the, I don't want to even call it task, because task is hard to classify in an LLM space. Like, you could call tool calling a task, but it's going to be much more around like domain. Like, what domain is the model really optimized to work well in? And of course, you're still going to have the frontier labs that are trying to just be the best at all domains, right? And you can do that by just pushing the parameter count up, and the training data improvements. We'll get to that in the next segment, obviously. But I think, you know, especially at the smaller model sizes and the open source shops, you're going to probably see the ones that succeed choosing their specialties and trying to find a niche market in a specific domain.
Yeah, I think that differentiation is going to be really interesting to see, because it's like almost in this game of musical chairs, it's like, how many chairs are there for you to specialize in this space? Aaron, I want to bring you in. You know, obviously with Gabe and Abe on the line, they're very open biased. But do you want to talk a little bit? Have you played with Opus 4.5? I'm curious about your impressions on Claude and what Anthropic's doing with the new model.
Yeah, I mean, just to sort of piggyback off, you know, your comment about the musical chairs. I mean, the good news is that the music never stops here. You know, because we have lots of models coming in, very performant, right? And What I personally like to do is to ensemble different models together, you know, because it's almost like this optimization problem, right? Where you have lots of different models, right? And you need to optimize against an objective function that you're trying to achieve, right? But that objective function also is baked in there. What models do you select? But you can have a router that in turn looks at the ideal use cases for each of these models, you know, such as the Mistral 3. It seemed to be, you know, really good at these enterprise RAG systems, right? And wanting to have these different chatbots or co-pilots and some of it for a vision. Whereas if you look at DeepSeek, you know, 3.2, it's very great, you know, at math and different types of, you know, code gen. But I also noticed that the Opus 4.5, it seemed to extend this notion of a digital worker, right, where you could maybe even replace or augment, you know, humans, where, you know, you will actually have an engineer, you know, a virtual engineer that would read the entire 200-page spec of a language, which we generally wouldn't do, right? So, I mean, that's quite helpful there, you know. And then as you begin to create a router that then in turn pushes out, you know, your prompts, right? And then it pulls in the data of which each of the models have access to. You then in turn have to consider the different topologies that I know Gabe was mentioning, right? Whether it's going to be, you know, Mistral's open weight mixture of experts with these different types of attention transformers that they have, DeepSeek with their sparse attention MOEs, and then Claude, where it has, you know, this agentic enhancements and memory state layers. But what I think is going to happen, right, is with, you know, as these models come in, we're going to have more hybrid architectures, right? So I think the day of just having a transformer is going to be no longer where you're going to see state-space models being put in and mixed together, which is going to make it very exciting, right? Just the different emergent behaviors that are going to happen, especially when socially these models begin to interact and, you know, play together.
Maybe a final question here, and then I'll move us on to our next topic. You know, at least on the topic of Opus 4.5, which is the one out of these three models I've played the most with, they're really getting quite good at personality, it feels like. My friend had a really funny incident where he was having a conversation with Opus 4.5, and then, you know, they're talking about one topic and then moved on to another topic. And then, like, many turns later, Opus says, like, oh, you know, I've been thinking about that thing that we were talking about earlier, and I think you're right on that issue. There's, like, kind of this, like, very weird moment where it's, like, the model kind of does this callback in a very kind of, like, natural way that you might have, you know, in having a conversation with someone. I'm kind of curious if any of you have kind of, like, your sort of, like, vibe and flavor check across these models, either with the 4.5 or otherwise. It does feel like the 4.5 kind of nailed something with the voice. But curious about what you think about that, if any of you have kind of played with it, and what do you think?
It's really interesting to hear you say that, because, like, frankly, that's exactly the opposite of how I use models, right? Like, I don't think I've ever gone more than four or five. It's exactly. I use them as a functional sounding board, the way I might have a colleague where I used to stand up and walk over to their desk and be like, hey, let me vomit words at you. And then, like, you'll ping a few back at me. And all of a sudden, like, the right answer will emerge.
Yeah,
right?
And be like, okay, thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you. Goodbye. Exactly. And wipe your memory, start over again. No, So my vibe check is much more about sort of the responsiveness and the collaborativeness in those functional experiences. Models that are open to when I point out something that they got wrong, refining their suggestion and or taking that, like that is my vibe check right now. Because I use them almost exclusively for technical related topics, whether it's checking my own code, helping to understand a programming language or a accelerator paradigm that I'm not familiar with. But I do have deep expertise in some of the aspects around what I'm doing. And so a lot of times I'll catch something that they did wrong, but they'll have some insight that I don't. And the ability to collaborate back and forth is what really like resonates as quality for me. I'm not so much in the chatty mode usually. I think everyone probably has their own vibe check depending on how they like to use models.
Yeah, totally. That goes to the chairs question, right? It's like these use cases are really so varied that like that's going to be the specialization. So very interesting. I'm going to move us on to our next topic, which is related to some of the stuff that we're talking about here. One of the folks connected to MOE flagged this interesting blog post from a VC from Theory Ventures called Tomas Tungas. And he kind of pulls together a couple different threads, but sort of the core of his article, this blog post that he did, was sort of arguing that Gemini 3 kind of demonstrates that maybe the scaling laws are still pretty good. Like that essentially with like a ton of compute using the methods we know, we can still see some like major capability improvements. And, you know, I know last week we did talk a little bit about Gemini 3, but it's sort of interesting kind of putting it in that context. We talked a little bit about sort of what you can use Gemini 3 for. This is maybe a little bit of like how it is maybe informative about how the meta competition around these models is evolving. Abraham, maybe I'll kick it over to you. Is do you buy the thesis? Like scaling laws, maybe still better off than we thought. We just got to throw more compute at it.
Yeah, I'm sure NVIDIA would love that. So I think that Google's a little bit different in this case, specifically because they've got full integration of hardware and software as it uses its TPUs.
Right. They have like the most computers that ever computed, kind of.
Exactly. You know, so it's much different than a shop using GPUs that might not have the same integration across the whole stack. So I think, TPUs and Google have a little bit of an unparalleled advantage when it comes to being able to squeeze as much out of the processing units. So I think if we were to see this type of, behavior, if you will, with a different model, for instance, if the new Claude Opus 4.5 or DeepSeek were to be able to showcase, some of the, contradictions to the scaling laws, I think we just need a different, another proof point, if you will. And in reading some of the material from the Gemini, they did some other things, or at least, they alluded to some other concepts or updates in their strategy in terms of how they build their model that could lean into it. I read a comment about, context engineering in place of prompt engineering, where, the thought process was maybe behind the model generation, it grabs a bunch of large relative context in the background so it can, provide a little bit more of a thought experiment before it generates the results. I guess to kind of close the button on Gemini, I'd love to see maybe another proof point that is a little bit more focused on GPU use as opposed to TPU. And then in terms of the other part of that article that said, subsequent to Google's comment, NVIDIA's growth is still, their last Q3 release showed that they're still have a massive output of GPUs. Most GPU sales aren't for pre-training, they're for inference. So I don't necessarily think that's like the right.
Yeah, that one I felt was like a little bit of a weak argument, is basically
exactly.
Just buying compute doesn't mean that the scaling law still applies.
That's exactly it.
Yeah, for sure. William Gibson has this famous quote, which is like, the future is here, it's just not widely distributed. And I guess this kind of makes me think about like, the scaling laws are here, this is just not widely distributed. In the sense that basically, and Aaron, I'm curious about your comment on this, is like, we may live in a future where, sure, I guess maybe the scaling laws kind of still exist, but the amount of infrastructure you need to pull it off is basically only available to maybe only Google. Like, it's just like, the scale is just so huge. For everyone else, there kind of will not be a scaling law. Do you think that's kind of the case? Is that basically like it will, because we're sitting this kind of period of diminishing returns, you can only keep it going if you're like at like the 99.99th percentile of access to compute. And for everybody else, we're just in a world where scaling laws kind of don't exist anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the scaling curve, you know, it's going to be like this little stepwise, you know, function. You know, so you have all these little S curves that happen, you know, as we get new technology breakthroughs, right? So it's multi-dimensional, right? And I think there's going to be new dimensions as we progress through a time, right? So like as new topologies come or new algorithms are designed, I think that's going to help the smaller players to be more competitive. You know, you potentially don't need these, you know, huge data centers with, you know, these large amounts of GPUs. Because they might be able to improve performance without needing to change, you know, any of that. But I also wanted to make the point too is that one of my litmus tests around the scaling law is I look at, you know, us humans, right? And you know we have this biological scaling law. You know, our brains, they haven't changed much, you know, over the course of centuries, right? But our tools and our technology have. So the more data and knowledge, that we get, we still have that same topology. Right? We're just able to specialize and to have different types of training, right? Which is less consuming, right? I mean, I know it's not a perfect analogy because, you know, AI gets better maybe with the more GPUs you add, but humans get worse with the more coffee you add, right? But, but I mean, it kind of helps.
Yeah, so. Totally. Yeah. I think, I mean, the biological metaphor is good too, because it's like, it's also, after all this evolution, we don't have infinitely large brains. Right. And so there's almost kind of a view, which is, yeah, we actually found an equilibrium. Like, actually, you only need so much intelligence to get through most of the problems you're going to confront. Yeah, it's actually, I think it's a really interesting metaphor.
Right. And I mean, if you look at Gemini 3, you know, it kept roughly the same number of parameters, you know, roughly 1 trillion, you know, with respect to Gemini 1.5. Right. So it's almost like the human brain where it's, you know, the same sort of topology. I mean, I'm sure that they've, you know, changed different types of activation functions and so on, you know, but size-wise, right, it's somewhat static, right? So it is a bit interesting, but keep in mind that stepwise function that's going to, you know, happen much like what's happened, you know, with compute, you know, with quantum, right? So I do think that, you know, circling back to your original question, that the small players will still, you know, have a big say.
Gabe, I think maybe there's a final question here, which is the obvious comparison to these scaling laws is Moore's law, right? Which used to be this industry organizing law that said processing power is just going to increase. And, you know, I think the right observation about Moore's law is not like it's some, you know, mystical law of nature. It's because the whole industry was like, we got to keep Moore's law going. And like, it was only kept going because every few months we were able to get another innovation to keep it going again. And so, you know, there's a way of looking at the scaling laws, which is it's not necessarily, again, some like inevitable law of nature, like gravity or something like that. It's more of kind of like a shelling point that causes the industry to kind of focus on certain types of things. And so, yeah, curious about what you make of that. Is that the right interpretation of what we're seeing here?
Yeah, I think it is a very interesting, you know, it's kind of progress for the sake of progress, but there's probably some genuine utility coming out of that progress, but it's definitely sort of the competition is feeding the progress more so than the actual need for the progress. But, you know, Moore's Law is an interesting one because Moore's Law is actually like pretty explicitly measuring like floating point operations per second, right? Like it's a very specific linear, unidimensional metric, right? And there are all sorts of clever ways to, you know, improve that by not just making one faster chip. You can do a bunch of things in parallel and do some clever metric, you know, whatever. The thing about this hypothetical scaling law in AI is it just even framing it as a scaling law to me seems like the wrong point. Like Aaron, you pointed out that Gemini didn't change the number of parameters. So we're not scaling size. They don't really tell us whether they scaled the data inputs, but they probably scaled to more data. Do you consider algorithmic improvement scaling? Maybe. Like my guess based on that, you know, tiny tweet is that most of the improvements were actually how they trained, not, you know, just bigger, right? And I think the framing of this as a scaling law is kind of a bit of a misnomer. I think it's a quality improvement law. And in some ways, it's kind of a no-brainer that we are nowhere close to the wall on that, because when you have an iteration cycle that costs millions of dollars and takes months, yeah, it's going to be really hard to, you know, actually move that ship, right? Like, you know, as a developer, I want something that takes, you know, fractions of a second and say, oh, that didn't work. Try something else. That didn't work. Try something else. As a model developer, you have to press go and wait for months and burn millions of dollars in the process, right? So those experiments are expensive. Iterating in the algorithmic space is really hard for these models. So in some ways, it's not at all surprising that there's a lot of probably still low-hanging fruit to be grabbed by doing better things in that training space, curating your data better, figuring out your actual training loops, figuring out your mixture of synthetic data, all of the above, right? There's so many tricks you can play to actually steer the training process of these models. And, you know, I would bet that if we were to somehow, you know, do some back of the napkin math on how many different out of the theoretical possible ways you could tweak and tune this hyperparameter space for training is, I bet you we've explored a tiny fraction of the hyperparameter space for training large language models, just purely based on the speed at which they can operate. So I think the one thing that is interesting in this scaling law discussion is that as hardware actually gets faster at doing this, the ability to experiment and try new algorithms gets greater. And so that may actually be the real point of scaling, where we can start just exploring that space of hyperparameters in the training space faster, and therefore get to better quality outputs more quickly.
Yeah, that's a cool interpretation. That's like basically that, like, it's not actually about the hardware in a certain sense. Like,
yeah, the hardware probably has a role to speed up that iteration cycle.
Yeah,
but it's not just more hardware, more hardware, more hardware.
Yeah, that's right. It's really a scaling experimentation law, right? Basically, like, it's not just add more compute. It's add more compute so a bunch of folks can experiment, which causes algorithmic improvements, which is really where the results are coming from. That's really interesting. All right, I'm going to move us on to our last topic of the day, a business story, a very interesting one. You know, throughout the entire year, we've been talking about agents. ChatGPT launched, you know, one of the most obvious kind of agentic features, which is something called shopping research. So the idea is you're going to use ChatGPT to go do your holiday shopping. ChatGPT will go out to the world and find products that match the kinds of queries that you're looking for. And when you think shopping on the internet, you, of course, think Amazon, the place for which you buy a lot of things. The news came out, I think just earlier this week, that Amazon will be blocking the ChatGPT shopping research agent from looking at product detail, customer data, deals on Amazon. So super interesting development, right? Because instantly that makes a product like, or a feature like shopping research, maybe a lot less effective, right? Insofar as Amazon really is the infrastructure for all sorts of shopping online. Aaron, I'll kick it over to you for maybe the obvious question, but I think it's worth making it explicit. Why is Amazon blocking ChatGPT?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, just to start out with, it's as if like Amazon told ChatGPT shopping bot to go window shopping, but yet the door's locked. You know, it can't go in and it can't, you know, look at the data and understand you sort of, you know, the product listing or prices or any of that. And it seems as though that Amazon might have done this for a couple of reasons. You know, one of them could be to protect their e-commerce data, right? So that third party tools can't just directly access that. Right. So they keep control of their shopping funnel. Right. And then that door's locked, so nobody else can go in. And it protects their business model, right, for ads, commissions, first party traffic, and so on. But I think a subtlety, or maybe not so subtle, right, is that Amazon is also working on, you know, their own AI-driven shopping services, right? They have Alexa Plus, right, that's coming. They have Rufus, right? So those two elements, I think, you know, they're trying to keep their own ecosystem. But I think what this ultimately means is that we have these turf wars, right, that are starting, right, where we have this open shopping AI versus closed retail empires, right, that we have going. And what this could mean is that maybe, and it'd be pretty neat if this happened, but these smaller retailers could band together so they could collectively compete against Amazon, you know, so there's thousands and thousands of mom and pop shops, you know, that now could compete against the big elephant, you know, and so we'll just have to see. But I am curious to, you know, if Amazon is now being pushed through competition to double down on Rufus, right, and to really invest more in Alexa Plus, and what is that going to mean to us as we begin to shop for the holidays, right? I hope for one, I could save, you know, right? Some money, you know, with these tools and find the best products, you know, but we'll have to wait and see, but it's exciting news, I think, overall.
Yeah, the parallel story, which I was thinking a little bit about, is, you know, a few months back, Cloudflare, right, said, we're going to start blocking AI agents. It's going to be by default, you can't get through. And I think what they said was, look, we're standing up for all these websites, and eventually we're going to create a little bit of a toll booth. So if you want to access the data on a website, you'll have to come through Cloudflare, and we're going to make sure that they pay. I guess, Gabe, you know, there's been a lot of talk on whether or not agents are technically possible. It kind of feels like there's a big question on whether or not they're even possible as a matter of business incentive. It relies on an internet where you can just access information. You can just access different platforms. But it feels like the walls are going up everywhere. It feels like that could actually really stifle the whole dream of agents really even being a practicality.
Yeah. You know, I think you are definitely right that we're hitting a point in this AI timeline where all of a sudden making money is going to really matter. And that kind of stinks as a technologist, right? Like, it's been really fun to just have this ride where all these big shops are just putting out great technology and thus far haven't been really tying that to revenue goals specifically. You know, I can say one of the things that I turn to ChatGPT for is questions that I don't want to later show up in my Google News feed or my Google ads, right? Like, you know, I love that in many cases, these AI technologies have not yet been linked into the money machine. And it's just been a matter of time before that happens. And so clearly this is one very big step in that direction, right? And the thing that I think is interesting is to speculate out a little further and think about this almost like where the browser wars hit and the inevitable antitrust lawsuits that came around browser, you know, defaults and browser walls, right? So I suspect that at some point agents will become the new browser. I don't think I'm alone in that speculation. Like, I think a lot of people will go to the internet through their agent, at which point the idea of having sort of a tight, vertically integrated ecosystem that precludes some agents from accessing some content is probably going to be challenged in court, frankly, because it's going to have, you know, monopolistic tendencies. So, you know, I think we've seen this with browsers. We've seen this with search engines. I suspect we'll see this with agents eventually. But right now, agents are still in that sort of middle ground where they're just coming out of the, oh, this is awesome technology and we're just figuring out what to do with it phase. And they're just entering the, hey, we can make a ton of money with these things phase, so we better protect our moat. And I suspect we'll come to the, like, you know, commoditized and or, you know, like legally regulated phase in a little while.
Yeah. Abraham, I think I'll give you the last word on today's episode. I mean, what do we do about this dynamic that Gabe is talking about? It sort of feels like, you know, the whole point of the agent is that there's one agent that you can use to do everything that you want to do, say, across the internet. Where this is going seems to be like, okay, well, you got the ChatGPT agent, but if you want to buy something on Amazon, you got to use the Amazon agent, basically, which, like, kind of destroys the whole original value prop, I think, for agents in a certain sense. It certainly makes it, like, a lot more annoying to manage. Is there a way to get back to the world of sort of free-flowing agents that kind of, like, operate on your behalf generally? Are we kind of by dint of the business incentives here kind of being pulled towards a world of, like, it'll just be app world again, right? What used to have an app, now you just have an agent that replaces that, but will be effectively the same world.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, off the top
I'm just giving
head,
you a small one to wrap up the
yeah,
episode.
Yeah, no. You know what? Thinking out loud, maybe it's less of a, you know, a third-party agent that controls the entire, like, you know, it is your control flow into the internet, and it's more of a personal agent that calls particular third-party agents as they are approved or required. So from your experience, from an end user, I have an agent and it calls, you know, there's a multi-agent system that's for Abraham Daniels, and it can only call, or it calls the required agents or the agents that are tailored for the specific uses that I want to be able to carry out. But other than that, I know that's a very nebulous, very kind of, like, big hairy problem question that I generally don't have the full answer to. But I do think that, you know, this Amazon article really showcases, you know, platform competition versus AI competition. And what I thought was kind of neat about it was more so the opportunity to transition SEO to AI assistance. To Gabe's point in terms of, you know, trying to find dollars and cents after all, you know, the billions of dollars that have been invested into AI. I think, and I said this on a previous Mixture of Experts, I think OpenAI is now very, very focused on how to eventually turn all these agents and capabilities that they've built into some dollars and cents. So I really saw this as a way to kind of take some SEO capabilities away from the Googles of the world and see if you can start to utilize them as part of like your shopping experience with agents.
Yeah, that's a good note to end on. I mean, so obviously this will be not the last time we talk about this issue, but we are out of time for today. So Aaron, Gabe, Abe, awesome to have you on the show and hope to have you back soon. And thanks to all you listeners. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll see you next week on Mixture of Experts.